Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's special program, co-organized by the Museum of Performance and Design and the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. This program is also being held in association with the Commonwealth Club's LGBT and Arts Forums. I'm Brad Rosenstein, curator of exhibitions and programs at the Museum of Performance and Design, and your moderator for today. The Commonwealth Club of California is the nation's oldest and largest public affairs forum, bringing together its more than 16,000 members for over 400 annual events on topics ranging across politics, culture, society, and the economy. The Museum of Performance and Design is the first museum in the country dedicated exclusively to the performing arts and theatrical design. The museum's mission is to educate people of all ages about the impact and value of the performing arts in their lives through exhibitions, programming, and research. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org and the Museum of Performance and Design at mpdsf.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Tony Kushner, and I could easily take up our whole hour just giving you his list of credits and accomplishments and honors. What matters most to us today is that he's the author of Angels in America. Would you please welcome Tony Kushner? We're talking about a cultural phenomenon that has now a 20-year and ongoing history. But I'd like to start actually with now, because you just recently opened the first New York revival of Angels since the original Broadway production in 93-94. Could you talk a little bit about what it was like for you now at this point in your life to be re-entering the world of the play?
Well, I had a lot of fun working on the revival, and it's been an interesting experience with you, digging through files and archives. It's the play has occupied my life in one form or another, off and on, for 20 years. It took about 10 years to complete the writing of the thing, I mean, from the beginning of working on it till the national tour. And then there was a hiatus, and I worked with Robert Altman for a while on a possible film that didn't materialize, but I had a wonderful time working with him. And then the film did materialize with Mike Nichols directing it. Today is Mike Nichols' birthday, so happy birthday, Mike. I then thought that it would be a while before the play came back to New York, and the Signature Theater Company called and asked to do this revival. And I've had a great time getting back in touch with the script on a working basis, because I've watched productions off and on for years now, and when I did the screenplay for the film, I certainly got back into the material, but the film was so much Mike's creation. I mean, the director of the film is in a certain sense the author rather than the screenwriter, even though it was my play. I didn't really work at all in terms of performance during the film. I mean, Mike did that. I sort of sat behind one of those video monitors and watched occasionally when I was allowed to. Mike always let me come. There were a couple of actors who don't like working with a screenwriter in the room, so I stayed away during some of that. But it was mostly just the actors and Mike working on it, and this time around with a new group of actors digging into the plays, it was a lot of fun to go back and to talk about the scenes and how the scenes work and the mechanics of what's your character's objective in this scene and how does the character discover its objective and realize it. I mean, that was a lot of fun, and I did a lot of work on Perestroika. I always rewrite it whenever I get a chance, and this was a big chance. With a new group of actors, so that told me things that I didn't know, and I'm 20 years older than I was when I wrote it, and I've learned a few things, both technically and about life. So there were aspects of Perestroika that I suddenly heard differently and really had a lot of fun playing with. And as I said last night at the opening of the exhibit, and it is really an extraordinarily beautiful exhibit. So if you haven't seen it, I hope you will. I think that the museum and Brad have done just a magnificent job of taking a essentially kinetic thing, an event, and turning it into a spatial object of study and of contemplation. And I really love the way that sounds so dreary. Who would want to go and look at a spatial object of contemplation?
It's much better than
it's really there are wings all over the place and pictures of very attractive actors in no full frontal nudity, but they're still very attractive people.
When do we put the video in?
We'll have nudie pictures. but you know, it's been great to dig back into it and to play around with it. And I was saying at the opening last night, I said that yesterday morning I walked up to Cafe Floor and phoned in the last rewrite. I hope the last rewrite that I'll do for Perestroika. Even though the critics have already been, and everybody thought they were safe, but I just wanted to keep them on their toes. So I called the actor who's playing Pryor, and I fed him one last little speech. And now I think I'm done. And we'll soon publish the new edition of both plays, and that's it's great to have had the chance to play around with them that way.
Something I was curious about is did thinking about it in terms of a film have any influence on the changes that you made in Perestroika now on stage?
There was only one thing, and I mean, Mike, when he made the film Perestroika, there was a certain amount of editing involved. Some of it happened before we filmed, and some of it happened in the editing room. There's a huge difference between speech. I mean, I learned something very important about stage speech versus, I feel like I'm hissing my terrible little gap in my teeth. So I'll apologize if I'm driving anybody crazy. It's not you, it's me. There's so much more intimacy in a film because you're right there in the middle of the action. And I realized that stage speech automatically heats up human dialogue to compensate for the kind of cooling distance between the actors and the audience. We're doing this revival of Angels at the Signature Theater, which is my ideal. It's a little bit like Berkeley Rep's new proscenium house, where the stage is bigger than the audience, which is the sort of European jewel box version of a theater, and it's great. The signature seat's about 160-something people. But even in that intimacy, there's still 10, 15 feet of distance that words and actions have to travel, and everything cools down a little bit. So I think playwrights, since Aeschylus, have been cooking, heating things up so that it won't get too cold by the time it arrives. And when you see it on film, it very often sounds over the top and a little perfervid, and maybe there's too much of it. So the film was substantially edited. I mean, Perestroika runs at about 3 hours and 40 minutes with two intermissions, and the three episodes that make Perestroika in the HBO miniseries are, I think, around 3 hours. So it's they've lost about 15 to 20 minutes of dialogue. I didn't actually incorporate any of those cuts. Mike did point out that there's a scene in Perestroika that violates the play's own metaphysics, the scene in the diorama room. I don't want to go in. It's a long... one of the first things that he said to me is, I don't understand this scene. It's a scene where Pryor, Walter, and Harper Pitt meet in the diorama room at the Mormons Visitor Center, and something magical happens. There's a lot of magic in the play, but it's all done without any objective correlative. You never know whether or not the angel has really crashed through Pryor's ceiling or if it's a fever dream that he's having because he's very sick. And pretty much all the magic in the plays happens without any corroborating witness. The only place where that's not true is the diorama room. And Mike said, I don't get it, and I admitted that I don't get it either. So we cut it from the film. which means, unfortunately, there is a series of really good jokes in the fourth act of Perestroika that have to do with Pryor knowing that his ex-boyfriend is dating a Mormon that had to go, too, because Pryor didn't know that. And I feel in the film it works beautifully. You don't miss it, but I tortured myself endlessly, and everybody who would pick up the phone and talk to me, does the diorama room make sense to you? And I asked the actors that, and Michael Greif, the director, and everybody kept saying, yes, it makes sense to us, and I found that actually disturbing, because I still don't understand what it is. But I finally my husband, Mark, said, I said, you know, but I don't understand. It's happening in real time. I mean, he goes into the room, and then these dummies start talking, and Harper's there watching with him, and they're... And Mark said, what part of the expression gay fantasia do you not understand? It's like, you know, Ethel Rosenberg calls an ambulance for Roy. I mean, it's like, calm down and just, you know, don't worry about it.
Go with it.
So it stayed in, and every time it happens, I kind of cringe and feel like a bad playwright. But it's I've been working on the introduction for the 50th anniversary edition of Glass Menagerie. And I've been reading a lot of Tennessee Williams' letters and journals. And there's a thing where he's talking about, I think it's D.H. Lawrence, and he talks about a kind of hysterical quality in the writing and this is before he had written, you know, his great plays, but he talks about a place in which what we would consider conventional reality disappears and is replaced by a kind of hyperventilation on the part of the writer that he says, nevertheless, and I think this is he said it in several places in several ways on his way to writing Menagerie and then most importantly Streetcar. But it seems sort of like formative in his consciousness as a writer. He says that the hystericized version of reality, even though it's less immediately recognizable as ordinary experience, nevertheless gives you a much better sense of what the world feels like than something that's more faithful to conventional reality would
be. That's what I think is so brave about your writing. I mean, for me, in the first act of Millennium, the point in watching the play where it just got completely airborne is the scene where Harper and Pryor meet in what is a mutual dream, hallucination, and the stage directions of this scene say, is it his hallucination? Is it her dream? It's bewildering. I love the bravery of somebody saying that and just deciding to go with it because dramatically that is the scene you want to see. You want to see those two people connect, and it really doesn't matter how they do it.
It was funny because when we were working on the scene together, I was having a big argument with Michael Greif about whether or not the scene should happen in some fantasy space or should be staged in Pryor's bedroom, which is where Michael wanted to do it. And I went back to see what it said in the script, and I hadn't read Millennium Approaches in probably 15 years. And I saw that stage direction, and I thought, God, that was a nervy little thing to write.
It is, but it's perfect. Yeah. It's perfect, yeah, that you were brave enough to do that, I think, is really admirable. You and I have talked a lot about how important San Francisco was to this play. And as I was working on the curation of this exhibition, it became so apparent to me, not only in digging in the play, there are so many resonances and echoes of things that I think were related to what was going on in San Francisco at the time, late 80s, early 90s, that you were writing this, but also just the landscape of this. One of the things I was so charmed to find when the Eureka production was being rehearsed. They wound up, because they were out of money, they wound up having to rehearse in other people's theater lobbies at different times all over the Bay Area. But when they first started working on it, they started working on it one block from here at North's Auditorium. And that's where a lot of the first rehearsals took place. So it felt very close to me that this was happening. The Council of Principalities in Heaven is described as looking like San Francisco City Hall post-earthquake. He's talking about 1906, but at the time you were writing it, the 89 quake was also a very recent memory. So that building across the street is in the play. So that resonance, for me, became very important. And I wish you could talk a little bit about it, because I know this city was so important to you in the making of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, my career as a professional playwright started here. I mean, Oscar Eustace and Tony Taccone brought me, after Oscar had seen my play, A Bright Room Called Day, at a little theater that we rented in New York called Theater 22, which was one floor below a Korean S&M bordello called The King's Pleasure. We didn't realize until we were deep into rehearsals that was what it was, but we suddenly started hearing people walking up and down the stairs outside in high heel shoes and screaming in Korean, and then a lot of sort of rattling of chains and moaning. So we figured out it added. It was not quite as exciting as performing.
How great theater gets made, right?
Yes. Yeah. Our next production was done in something that turned out to be the during the daytime when it wasn't a theater, turned out to be a colonic irrigation salon, which was really not a problem until one of the irrigation specialists decided to do nighttime hours, and then it got complicated. But Oscar came to see the very first performance of Bright Room Paul Day, and then brought me to the Eureka to do a reading of it, and then they did the first professional production that I ever had here in San Francisco, and I fell completely in love with the city from the get-go, I don't think that the play. Well, I mean, literally, I was when Oscar said after Bright Room Called Day, "Would you like to write a new play for the Eureka?" I had been out of the closet at that point, I guess, for about 4 years. I was in a relationship with a man for the first time. I had a gay character in my very first play, written for Steven Spinella, but it was not in any way a play about being gay, and I felt like it was time to write about it, and I thought, well, it's for a theater company in San Francisco, so, you know, it's a perfect way to do this. And it was very, even though the Eureka Theater Company at that point was one straight man, Jeff King, and three straight women. But it still felt like this was the place to, it was an invitation to write about being gay in the middle of the 80s in Reagan America during the first years of the AIDS epidemic, and that became Angels. So, yesterday I walked from the hotel all the way up to Cafe Floor, which is a place that I sat in and wrote a number of scenes that are in the play now. And you know, it was a beautiful day. And it's just, the city is really one of the strangest and most remarkable places on the planet. And I remember the first months that I spent here just walking around. You know, when you spend a long time in New York City, you walk around and it's just, you can't believe how absolutely delightful the physical environment is, because New York is, you know, anhedonia central. It's so grim and tough and hard, and those of us who live there and are masochistic enough to enjoy it wouldn't live anywhere else. But the grace of this city always overwhelms me, and the people, and and, you know, so I feel like the play, although it's set in New York, is very much a San Francisco play, which is another reason why the exhibition is so overwhelmingly meaningful to me, is that it feels great that the connection is still strong.
It was interesting because for me, probably the heart of the exhibition are Tony's notebooks from Angels, and we've got just about all of them on display, and it was fascinating to me to see how it kept evolving from the early ideas, and very, very quickly you seemed to find the thread of what Millennium will be. It went through some really huge changes at the beginning, and there was actually going to be a character who was living in San Francisco at the time, and there was going to be a whole bicoastal relationship that was happening. And it's interesting to me that we kind of go there in a way in Heaven, and Harper's on her way here at the end of it, but no one ever actually arrives in
it's
San
true.
Francisco. Yeah,
and Marcia Day Harden, who played Harper in on Broadway, said to me one day, "You know, God, poor Harper. She finally leaves her gay husband and gets on a plane and flies to San Francisco." So somebody maybe still hasn't figured out how
somehow I somehow I think that Valium bottle is going to see more use. Yeah, when she gets here. Yeah, it's true. Actually, I was just looking through some of the questions we got handed, and I think it's a perfect moment to ask this. Will there ever be a part three of Angels?
I can't say never. For a while, I went around telling anyone who asked that was all I was going to do, was keep writing, you know, new installments of this with these eight characters. It was around the time of the national tour, and I really finished the work for the time being on Perestroika, and I had a really hard time letting go of these people. And I thought, okay, well, everybody wants to know what happens to Joe, so I could do that. And I've had ideas in the since so much of the AIDS pandemic now has moved to sub-Saharan Africa. I mean, I think 70% of people with AIDS are living there. That I thought of making, doing something with Belize, who's always been one of my favorite characters, bringing him back and doing something with him. And maybe I will. I don't know. I don't know. I'm always a little afraid of the...
Do you make Godfather 3?
I was just going to say, and then I thought, I don't want to say that because I revere Francis Ford Coppola and I would never... And I, you know, it's a much better movie than we thought at the time. It was just really nervy to take, you know, you make what are arguably the two best films in American history and or, you know, Godfather 2 is certainly one of the greatest films ever made and then you do another one and so I think I'm sure everybody who writes anything or makes anything, you know, thought, you know, better you than me, baby. But I don't know. I mean, you know, never say never. Maybe one of the characters will appear elsewhere. I like, you know, I mean, there's a speech in Perestroika, which is also in my play Slavs, which actually started out and was all written here in San Francisco as each act of Perestroika had a little Russian opening number, and then I removed them when Perestroika alone was about 6.5 hours. They all got taken away except for Alexei Antediluvianovich Prelapsarianov, the world's oldest Bolshevik, who makes the speech about theory, which is still the beginning of Perestroika. But all the other guys just went into Slavs. And so, you know, I don't know. We'll see. It's it's not what I'm planning to do right now. I'm working on another group of homosexuals, but they're completely unrelated to anyone in Angels in America. So,
I think the thing that still amazes me when I go through the plays is that the things that could so easily just be demonized from your perspective, because the play is written from your perspective. There's no question whose voice is behind it. But things like the Mormon Church and people like Roy Cohn, and that you don't do that. You seem, in fact, to get fascinated with them, and you want to show them in all their dimensionality. And I think that's why one of the reasons that makes these plays continually so fascinating and so rich is because you embrace, you know, what could so easily just become some kind of cardboard villain and really show it to me. The Mormonism especially I find fascinating because it seems to intrigue you so much.
Yeah, I mean, I was not particularly angry at the LDS church when I wrote Angels. I had taught a young Mormon girl in a school for gifted children in Louisiana in the summer a few years before I started working on it, and I had read the Book of Mormon at her bidding, but wasn't so impressed with the Book of Mormon, but was really, really delighted by this kid who just seemed like a remarkable person and who possessed many wonderful attributes that seemed to me the result of a very happy family life, which she made very clear to me had a lot to do with Mormonism. And I became interested in the history of Mormonism and its similarities to Judaism in terms of Exodus and a history of persecution and an actual physical book that has a kind of a sacrosanct position, an iconic position within the religion. And so, you know, and when I wanted to write a play called Angels in America, I mean, the authentic American angel is the angel Moroni. So I was drawn to Mormonism, and many aspects of Mormon theology were intriguing to me and fascinating to me. You know, it would be harder after Prop 8 and the disgraceful role. I mean, my impression is that the church has always had an official homophobic position, but, you know, big deal what church or religion doesn't have them. They're all sort of misguided on that subject and clearly are, you know, in the process of evolving. And some of them have actually managed to evolve. Okay. Others remain in the dark ages. Mormonism was never particularly good on the subject of homosexuality, and a lot of young gay and lesbian Mormons have been tortured and tormented as a consequence. But the political activism of Mormonism, it's always been politically active, but it felt to me that up until about the mid-90s, there was a kind of Eisenhower gray dignity to a lot of what the church was about. And then it sort of picked up the ugly new wind of kind of sulfurous evangelism and became much more aggressive and shrill in pushing its socially retrogressive agendas. And I don't think I could have written as fairly as I really genuinely believe I've written about them now, because I'm too mad about it. It's good not to, it's what Virginia Woolf says about, you know, Jane Austen and Shakespeare, is that she makes this amazing, in A Room of One's Own, the comparison between Austen and the Brontes, and, you know, how Austen, in spite of having, you know, every reason on earth to be a very, very angry woman, because she's a genius who has to, like, take care of 900 kids and all that stuff, seems to be able to write without any anger, and that may be what makes her books greater than the Brontes, if you feel that they are, is the absence of rage. Of course, what, you know, Virginia's really doing is making herself depressed because she felt that she couldn't write without anger, although in a certain sense I think that that's not true. But I think it helps not to be too mad. And I started working on the character of Roy Cohn after he had died, and I felt that the left was guilty of a lot of homophobia in the way that it was dealing with his demise. There was a great deal of old left homophobia in what I read about him after he had died, which made it possible for me to feel a kind of brotherhood with a figure who I'd always thought was a kind of a demon. And, I mean, that's what playwriting is, you know, that's what you're supposed to do. If you can't find the humanity in a character, don't write the character, because it'll be a bad part. It'll be of no real interest, I think, to anyone. So I think it's an essential part of writing well, is to be able to see the world as this person sees it.
Definitely. One of the questions that came up on a card is something that we've talked about before, and you addressed it a little bit before, the way the double casting, the multiple roles. You know, it came out of the fact that Tony, it's in his contract, which you could see up in the exhibition with the Eureka Theater, that he had to write for that specific company of actors. And that company at the time had more women than men, and so it's why a lot of the men's parts wind up being played by women. It was just a practical consideration. There have been theoretical tomes written on the meaning of the double casting in Angels, and it was really just a practical thing. But I think it goes beyond that, because you made it into a creative choice, as it were.
Yeah, I don't know that it was really entirely a practical. I mean, I knew the fact that Harper and Hannah both entered the picture had a lot to do with the fact that I had to write parts for two women, and the Angels gender, Sigrid Wurschmidt, the great, great, great Bay Area actress who died of breast cancer during the time that we were working on the play, but who was there in a very important way. Act two of Perestroika is dedicated to Sig, and she was just a great actress, and she was the angel, and the gender of the angel, which I think is now a really wonderful choice. I've seen productions, especially in Europe, where they don't feel that they have to pay any attention to your desires as a playwright. Many productions, including a really spectacular production, one of the best I've ever seen of the play, by Ivo van Hove, who's a kind of genius, and the Toneel Group in Amsterdam recently, where the angel was male. But I really love that Pryor, who I would imagine is a real six on the Kinsey scale, that his angel, it's in fact disturbing to him and surprising to him that his angel is not a man but a woman. And that had, in part had to do with the composition of the Eureka company. But the decision to do drag, but to do female-to-male drag, was not actually so much about... I mean, I could have written the play with parts for, you know, when the play was done at the National, they added a ninth actor because they didn't like the idea of the rabbi and several of the characters being played by women. It made them nervous in some way. I don't know why, because in Britain, you know, cross-dressing is, you know, something that everybody, including the Queen, I think, engages in. I don't actually know that she's ever been seen dressed as a man, or that Prince Philip has ever been seen in a frock. But
well, those kilts, you know.
From what I read, the Queen Mother had at least a number of friends who were often seen in frocks, sometimes her own frocks. But I wanted there to be drag in the play, and I thought it would be interesting to do female to male drag because we didn't get to see a lot of that. Eight became the magic number of the play. I wound up with eight sort of major parts. And I didn't want to go beyond that. And then there wound up being eight acts in the play, three in Millennium, five in Perestroika. And then one of the first lines is Roy Cohn saying, "I wish I was an octopus." So I have no idea what that means at all. But there it is. There are a lot of eights in the play. And I think that the gender, it works in some way. There's something really interesting about it, and I think it's fun. And Mike Nichols, one of the very first thing he said to me about the film was, and it's the first time I had ever met him. We met at a restaurant, and he said, "I'm excited about doing this, and I want to do all the doubling." And I was really shocked. I said, "Really, on film?" And he said, "Absolutely." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, because I want to see Meryl play Rabbi." And I thought, "Well, yeah, that's a very good reason." But because
all right.
I want to see her do everything. there was a joke version, a rough cut of Perestroika that I saw, where they, and I wish they had kept it in. At the end, they do the credits, and it says, you know, Al Pacino, and you see Al, and it shows, and they show some of the doubling, like Justin Kirk, and you see him as Pryor, and then you see him as the man in the park, and so on. And they did Meryl Streep, and every time they would show, like, a character who played multiple roles, they would show the Justin Kirk, and there you'd see him as Pryor, and then Justin Kirk, and you'd see him as the man in the park. So they did Meryl Streep as Hannah, and Meryl Streep as Ethel Rosenberg, and Meryl Streep as the rabbi, and then they found some immense drag queen from the funeral who was dancing and waving on Meryl Streep. And then
can't she play?
She can do anything. And she really actually can do anything. The woman is terrifying.
Her rabbi was extraordinary.
Oh, amazing. Extraordinary. Well, I've told the story many times, but Maurice Sendak is a very good friend of mine, and I've worked with Maurice. I wanted him to be in the movie, and he's actually in Fellini's Amarcord. He was hanging out at Cinecittà when they were filming it, and he's in one of the crowd scenes. But I wanted him to be in Angels, and so he and I play two Hasidic Jews who are hanging out with the old rabbi. And he knows Meryl. She did the book on tape version of Higgledy Piggledy Pop, which is, I think, his greatest book, and one of the great books ever about death and mourning. So they hadn't seen each other for a few years, but we all went to the set, and it was at a cemetery in Queens, and we got into the trailers, and we were all made up as chassids, and then we went into a tent because it was warm that day, and we were sort of being air-conditioned while we were waiting to be called onto the set, and Meryl was there as the rabbi, and Maurice came in, and she was talking to him, but she was staying in that amazing accent that she was doing, and sort of talking to him as the rabbi, and then we finished and we were walking to the set because it was time to shoot the scene, and Maurice turned to me and said, "Well, when is Meryl getting here?" And he literally had been sitting this close to her. And I thought he had looked really weird the whole time, like, why is this creepy old man, you know, spritzing me with water and stuff, and he didn't realize that it was her. And he wouldn't believe me at first when I said, "You've just been talking to her for an hour," and he really didn't believe, but it was astonishing. But I think that more importantly than the desire to have Meryl, you know, because we could have actually just only cast her and done the entire thing as a one-woman show. I think that the thing that made me feel really great was I thought, oh, well, this is exactly right, because Mike gets the theatricality of it, because the idea is to create an illusion that's not an entirely successful illusion, that where you know that you're seeing something that isn't what it seems to be. Because theater never creates a successful illusion. It only partially does. And it forces you, because of your emotional investment, to completely believe what you're seeing at the same time that you're completely aware that what you're seeing isn't real. And it has so much less power to convince you that it's real than film does, that it leaves an important contradictory space between what you know rationally and what your heart and soul are responding to, and the friction between those two things is what we call theatrical. It's what theater is, and it's where the power, that dialectic, is the power of the specific form of this live staged theatrical event. And I could tell from the minute Mike said that he wanted to do this that he got that. And I think that's one of the reasons that the film works so well, is that he doesn't deny that it's a play. There's this great thing that Vincent Canby said in a review of a film based on some play, I don't remember which one it was, but he said that what filmmakers always do is that they forget to include in the film, they always try to open the play up. And he says in doing that, they destroy the claustrophobia that is the heart of the theatrical event. And he's absolutely right about that. It's why Sidney Lumet's film of Long Day's Journey is so fantastic, because, you know, it's a stage. You're just in that room. And, I mean, who wants to see the Tyrones, you know, motoring around New London? Well, you really don't want to see that. And Mike did the same thing with Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Right,
I mean, there's a
exactly.
couple of stuff in the swing set, but it's you're trapped in the room with those monsters. And
right.
and you wouldn't want to be anywhere else.
Right.
And
exactly.
that's the...
Yeah. Well, Tony's got that great stage direction, which people quote endlessly now, about the use of magic in the play. And he's talking about specifically about the angel. And he said, you know, it's okay if the wires show, and it's even a good thing that they do, but it should also be absolutely fantastic magic at the same time. It's that Brechtian play.
Yeah. A lot of it has to do with, it is. I mean, Brecht has that great line in one of his theater poems that, you know, he had the half curtain that came across the stage, and the reason for it being a half curtain, it was about 8 feet tall, but you could see above it. And while you were watching what was going on in front of it, you would watch stuff going on behind it, a roof being lowered in or something. And he says it's there to remind the audience that this is not magic, but work. And, you know, and also, you know, one of the great things about the Eureka production, David S. Bjornson directed it and Sandra Woodall designed it, and the wings are on display. They're really gorgeous, gorgeous wings.
Beautiful.
Is that they're, you know, you see those wings and you see the wooden struts are sort of loosely based, I think, on Leonardo's flying machine, but you see the wires that are holding it together, and these two big wooden ribs that are the centerpieces. And it's a combination of something magical and something very human. There's that book that pops up out of the floor in the third act of Millennium. David is the only director, and Sandra's the only designer, who's ever actually made that thing work. And I remember, they had, you know, 15 cents, but it was all done with bungee cords, and it was a little puppet book. It's supposed to, the floor cracks open, the book flies up, it pops open, it bursts into flame, an aleph appears on its pages, it bursts into flames, it closes shut, and then goes back on the floor and disappears. And it's supposed to happen in like 20 seconds before you even can really take in that it's happening. And it doesn't work if it takes a long time, because it outstays its welcome. And with the more expensive the production, the more lumbering and sort of slow. And the audience is sitting there going, my God, how odd. What, you know.
What is that?
I wonder what's on television right now.
Right.
And I remember David waist deep in the bowels of the Eureka stage with bungee cords trying to get the thing, but they did it. It finally was just this kind of great, boink, 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 and it's gone.
Yeah.
And there was this like stunned silence and then shrieks of laughter, because it was so great that this huge elaborate thing had happened that lasted for 10 seconds.
Yeah.
And audiences loved that. And they used to do it. The 19th century had so much of that, and the 18th century. I mean, the invention of stage magic, with the cleverness of it, was the point. And we got so, you know, we surrendered so quickly to film. It's like, well, we can't do that. We can't have somebody just disappear. In the play, the stage direction is frequently given that the person disappears. And I've always had a fight with directors. I don't want the actor who's disappearing to just walk off the stage. It's like, yeah, well, we can understand that the person has disappeared, and that's, you know... It's, you know, well, the Japanese have, you know, people dressed in black. You know, it's like, whatever. But I finally, when I was talking about this with Michael in this new production, I realized if somebody actually disappears, and again, I mean, David at the Eureka had a wall made of Venetian blinds, basically, that you could just step through. Mm. And it would, and of course, you saw that. But if somebody vanishes, it's violent. It's not just magical, but it's abrupt. And when Harper in the mutual dream hallucination scene disappears on Pryor, who's come to like her a lot, you know, when you're very sick and you're afraid about your own disappearance, which seems suddenly imminent, having somebody that you care about vanish is terrifying and upsetting. And it's very different for the actor to have that happen rather than have the person that you've been talking to sort of turn on their heels and walk off stage. Even though you can play the convention, still your body, your instrument, is going to be saying, well, this person has just walked out on me, as opposed to this person was here and they're gone, which is like death. And I think that these things are really important. And it's a struggle to get us back into the realization that we don't have to compete with film. We can't compete with film, but that doesn't mean that we need to surrender that kind of invention. And I think it's great when you see directors really.
And there's so much that comes out just as happy accident. Something that Sandra and the designers were telling me. The Eureka production was the very first one in which the angel actually flew. And they were perfecting all of this, you know, right up to the moment, as has happened with every production of Angels. But they had literally just sawed the hole in the ceiling for her to come through right before they were doing, I think, one of the first previews. And they had wanted some kind of transformative effect to happen, not just her coming down in a shaft of light. They wanted something to happen, smoke or something, but nothing was working. They were trying all these high-tech solutions to make it look magical. And finally, they just carved the hole and put Ellen in the rig and said, okay, just drop her through the hole. She came through the hole. They had not cleaned up the sawdust. The sawdust fell into the light, and it fell at this perfect pace, and they all screamed. They said, that's it. That's the solution. And that they used for every performance afterwards. Sawdust.
You know? And Ellen spent the rest of the run cleaning sawdust out of her nose and eyes.
There are such horror stories.
Oh, my God.
Every person who has played the angel has a breakdown moment that they have described to me.
Well, now Robin Weigert, who's playing it in New York. And, I mean, the corset that holds you up in the air is horrible. Your body starts to bend because it's carrying a weight in a way that it's not supposed to. And Ellen had to hire a masseuse, whatever, I don't remember the gender, but when we were on Broadway, because she was really, I mean, her body was just in agony. When we did it at the Taper, she was on some kind of a pivot thing so she could do all these wonderful things in the air. But they couldn't get the tension out of the wire, so she kept spinning like a top. And there was one horrible moment in tech when it caught first her wig and yanked her wig off, and then her hair, and we started. It was hideous. And so, it's a really tough thing to do.
Well, even on the film version, J. Rory Helland, the brilliant makeup, the guy who transformed Meryl into that rabbi. Was saying because they did it, it was not CGI, it was Emma Thompson in a rig 25 feet in the air. And it becomes so traumatic to the actor's body, they would have to take a break after about 15 minutes and get everything off her just to get circulation back and, you know, so she could go on and do the scene. It ain't easy, Mr. Kushner.
No, it's a tough thing.
Yeah. I'd like to open things up now to the audience for questions. There's a microphone on one of the aisles, if we can bring the lights up. So feel free to come on down, and we can ask some questions. I know I'm supposed to say something also for radio. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is Tony Kushner, Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright of Angels in America, who's discussing Angels at 20 and its continuing legacy. Yes?
On the short level, the things we enjoy in movies are often easily seen as stunts, as forework, as not magic, and now CGI has made that disappear. And for me, it's taken away some of the pleasure of watching stunt work and magic in movies, because you can do or be anything with CGI. And it takes away from that mixture of reality and fantasy of which you speak.
Yeah,
I'm really here today to just say to you, thank you for these experiences. A play does not live 25 years because of its words, or because we understand it, but because it just gets to us. And that makes this one of the most important journeys in our lives. So in that sense, thank you.
Well, thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. I agree with you. I mean, you know, CGI is an interesting thing. I was absolutely blown away by Avatar. I thought, okay. And I was relieved to see Martin Scorsese sounding exactly the way I felt when I walked out. I thought, okay, I'm now watching the future arrive. This is the beginning of something that is a power here that's being unleashed for a kind of enveloping illusion that is so much greater than, I mean, I felt like, well, this must be what it felt like to people to see the first motion pictures in at the turn of the last century. The flat screen is clearly going to be gone in a few years. The idea of watching something that, on an architecture that resembles the proscenium arch is clearly going to become a thing of the past. And what in Avatar is three-dimensional on a flat screen is going to become overwhelmingly enveloping. And it was enormously. And then, you know, these actors, the Na'vi, sort of these computer-generated creatures. I mean, you know, obviously in a few years they'll be indistinguishable, except of course maybe not. There's the whole interesting question of, you know, the valley of the uncanny and how if something is almost human but not quite, it's much creepier. Apparently watching those computer-generated cartoon people are disturbing in a way that watching computer-generated bunny rabbits aren't. Because you know the bunny rabbit is not supposed to be human, but if it gets close enough to being human but isn't quite, it freaks everybody out, and which makes a lot of sense. But we're clearly going to cross that barrier fairly soon and have not have that degree of dissonance. The power of that is immense. It's terrifying because, of course, it suggests the power to manipulate consciousness in a way that always freaks people out, and it should. It freaked people out when they invented movable type. It freaked people out when they translated the Bible. It freaked people out when they invented photography, and then when they invented the motion picture. It freaked people out in the Middle Ages when they started putting on little plays in churches during, you know, Mass, and then moved them out on the streets. And they were right to be freaked out, because human consciousness is a malleable thing, and it changes all the time. It's, you know, it hardly needs to be said. The digital revolution has radically altered human consciousness in ways that we don't begin to understand, and that alteration is an ongoing process, and we don't know what kind of people we'll be in years to come. It's very moving to me that Cameron chose as the subject of this a kind of a rejection of technology and an interesting sort of left anti-corporatist, anti-militarist ideology as the subject of this. It's a little bit like all those people in the early days of Hollywood deciding the first thing they wanted to film was stage actors doing stage plays. It's kind of like before you run the thing over and, you know, kill it, you sort of acknowledge that it's a very nice thing that you're about to, you know, like Edison electrocuting the elephant. It's like, well, you know, here's a real elephant and we're going to kill it on film because soon film will kill all elephants. So, you know, It's a moving thing to me. But I thought it was a really fascinating thing, and I agree. I mean, you don't know now when you watch, you know, there's a huge difference between watching, you know, one of those big Hollywood epics where they actually had to get, you know, 50,000 Israelites to march across the desert and, you know, led by Charlton Heston. And now all the Israelites and Heston himself, who as an actor much resembled a CGI creation. You know, it's all on computer. So, you know, it's like, well, that's pretty impressive, except it was made by some guy in a, you know, a hoodie in some desert community in California going, you know, so it's not as impressive. But it's an amazing new world, and I think it's an exciting one. And I've started to work on I've got hired to do a script for an animated feature for the first time, and became very interested in these technologies. I don't know if I'll finish the script or if it'll happen, but it's an interesting thing, and it always makes me very happy to go back to theater, where I sat for 2 weeks watching some intern at the Signature Theater trying to figure out how to get the feather that falls from the sky at the end of the dream hallucination scene. How to make that happen without the feather flying into the audience. And I thought, well, you know, here we are. This is theater. This is great. It's like, he'll never get it. It'll never happen. It'll never work because feathers don't go where you want them to go.
And that single effect has been the hardest for every production to achieve, that one feather falling.
And they, you know, and then Forrest Gump came out the same year that we were doing one of the first productions of Millennium, and there's a feather that flies through everything, and it costs them like something like $157 million to make this feather float around. And then, well, you know, there's always that. They're apparently trying that now with Spider-Man on Broadway, but, you know, good luck. It's just, at some point, it's, you know.
It is what it is.
It is what it is.
Next question.
So I have what I hope is a simple process question. There's so much historical and political research in all your work. And I was wondering if reading is the enemy of writing. Is there a point where you turn your back on all the reading and just do the writing, or do you constantly go back and do research?
It depends on the play, really. I mean, I continue to do research on some level all the way through the process of working on the play. Some plays are much more research intensive. Homebody Kabul, my play about Afghanistan, was,
I know it,
you know, very, very research intensive. And I continued my research all the way through the production. I mean, we had, you know, Afghan people helping us speak in Pashtun. And that became part of the research because they were, you know, telling us, one wonderful man who's now moved back to Kabul explained to me, I said, how do you say, there was a line, I think it's not in the script anymore, but it was a line, no, it is, where he says, one of the Taliban guys at the end says, all British men are homosexuals. And the Afghan guy said, I can't translate that into Pashtun. And I said, why not? He says, well, there are no homosexuals in Afghanistan. So I, you know, it was an interesting process. But there's a point at which you begin to realize that the enormously intensive research that you're doing is serving both a purpose of informing the play or the screenplay and also serving the purpose of keeping you from actually having to write anything. And when you get to the point where you think, your body will sort of tell you, it's like, okay, you don't need to read yet another book about whatever. You just, you know, go ahead and sit down and be brave and try and write some dialogue instead. And you'll kind of know when you get to that point.
Yes.
I'm glad we segued into your work with Steven Spielberg, because I wanted to ask you, when I saw Munich, which you worked on, it's one of the first times I've been moved by a particular character into my philosophical worldview. And I'm thinking of Michael Lonsdale's Papa. And it's been nagging at me, because they seem so larger than life, those characters in Avner's Odyssey. To what degree is Papa an allegory for God or the Father or something like that?
I didn't think of him as being an allegorical figure at all. I made up a very specific, this guy is a gangster of some kind. I was fascinated by the descriptions in the stuff that we were reading about these Mossad hitmen who had conducted this assassination campaign, that there was this group apparently that helped them find the Palestinians that they killed. And I can't remember if the idea that he had been in part of the resistance, a non-Jewish, but part of the resistance during the Nazi occupation of France, if that was my idea, if that came from the historical record. But I was thinking about him and his children, and I started going back to the writings of the Situationists, the 60s French. It's an amazing combination of Marxist philosophy, Freudian psychoanalysis, and terrorism and anarchism as a synthesis that only the French could have invented. And I Guy Debord and those people who had such an immensely important contribution to make in terms of, really advancing Marx's analysis of capitalism, making it apply to the sort of post-industrial Western world, and I read a lot of those guys while I was working on him. So I'm glad you like him. I like him too. And Michel Lonsdale is just an astonishing actor, and that's one of my favorite parts of that film. So,
and thank you for him. So.
I did. There's a recipe that he uses when he's cooking with Avner. That I'm not a very good cook, and I made up the recipe, and I thought it just sounded something about boiling unripe plums. And while he was doing the scene, I heard him muttering, he said, this is complete nonsense. These would taste terrible. I was like, the guy's French. And I thought, well, you should have known better than to try and do that. So he said, like, we didn't change the lines.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, while we're on the topic of film, one of the questions that came through the cards, and I've also been very curious about it, is the film you're working on about Lincoln. Sounds fascinating to me, and I'm curious what the approach is that you're taking with Spielberg.
I can't really talk about it too much. I mean, I think it's looking very good for the thing. I've been working on it for 6 years, and I've been it's probably the hardest writing that I've ever done, but I feel like it absolutely transformed me in the process. It changed my politics to a certain extent. Like everybody, I think, who studies Lincoln, I've fallen madly in love with him and can't stop reading about him and thinking about him because I do think that there's an interview on NPR, an NPR podcast about the Lincoln Memorial. Susan Laurie Parks is interviewed on it. And there's another woman, I don't remember who it is, but she talks about being brought to the Lincoln Memorial when she was a little girl and thinking that it was a temple and seeing this figure who she assumed was God, and it's Lincoln, the French sculptor of Lincoln in the memorial. And she said, so I feel like I was right that this is the God of democracy. And one of Lincoln's secretaries, John Hay, said many years after the assassination, he said that I can't remember the exact quote, but he basically says, to the extent that anything as secular as democracy could ever be said to have a Christ figure, one would have to say that it was Lincoln. And there is something like with Shakespeare or Mozart or Newton, somewhat divine about Lincoln, something beyond, I mean, great, great genius on that level. And there have been like five or six of those people ever in human history. Genius on that level isn't entirely human in the normal sense. There's something going on that we can't really, it's a mystery that we can't comprehend, that human consciousness is capable of creation on that level. You know, go figure, how did somebody write Hamlet? It's just not comprehend. I mean, how did this man write Così fan tutti? I mean, it's just, you know, anyone who thinks that they understand it is nuts. So you just stand in awe, and how anyone led this country through the 4 years of the Civil War, kept the country intact, preserved the idea of democracy at a time when democracy was very much an idea that was up for grabs and had a very uncertain destiny, and proved that a people's democracy would not necessarily devolve into anarchism, and most importantly of all, turned what was originally a civil war into a revolution that eliminated slavery in the United States and to a certain extent was the end of the Middle Ages, really, the end of slavery as an acceptable human institution, an institution that could be enshrined in law, which was something that didn't happen after the Civil War. So I think that he's and wrote, you know, the Gettysburg Address, and the second inaugural address, which is the greatest political speech, the greatest speech ever given by anyone in the history of human speech. So, you know, I mean, he was not only, beyond question, I think one of the great political leaders, if not the great political leader of all time, he was a writer who could hold his own with the other people who were writing at the time. I actually have now found proof that he met Hawthorne, Melville, and Whitman. The only one that you can't say that he ever met was Emily Dickinson, because, of course, she never left her room, so she couldn't have met him. But those three, he actually had physical contact with the three of them, and that's kind of exciting to think about.
Absolutely, you know? Yeah. Yes?
My question is, in creating this work, did you have a specific message that you wanted remembered? And if so, has that message changed over the past 20 years?
I don't ever have a message to... If I had a message, I'd just, you know, print out a little fortune cookie and hand them out of the door and save everybody 6.5 hours of time. You could all go home and watch Project Runway. You know, which of course, anybody with any sense would really, you know, prefer to do. I mean, theater is hard, and Project Runway is so much fun, even though the decision this year is... Michael Kors came to... I was standing in the box office with Jim Houghton, who runs the Signature Theater, and I heard this voice that sounded familiar, and I turned, and it was Michael Kors who was getting his tickets to see the show. This was during previews. And I immediately became like a hysteric. I was like, oh, my God, it's Michael Kors! It would have been so much more embarrassing if it had been Heidi Klum, because then I really would have probably, you know, peed myself. But I made Jim take a picture of me with Michael Kors so I could email it to all my friends. And I'm really glad that it was before the finale, because I would have really had to yell at him. Because, you know, obviously Mondo should have won. Right? I mean, come on. I don't remember what I was saying. Well, so I don't have a message, except that, you know, watch Project Runway. I think that plays shouldn't have them. I don't think that you should, you know, I don't think that's the power of theater. I don't think it should proselytize. I don't think that it should seek to advise in that way. I think it is absolutely preaching to the converted. I've said this a million times, because where else do preachers preach? I mean, I don't like evangelists. Good preachers preach in their own churches full of people who subscribe to their faith. You don't usually go into an Episcopalian church and find it full of, Muslims or Jews. You find it full of Episcopalians. So what does a great Episcopalian preacher, what did John Donne do when he preached? He was a great preacher, and his sermons are extraordinary because he talks about the necessary concomitant to all great faith, which is doubt and confusion. And you start in the dark, and you go forward in the dark with your flock, who are never sheep-like, but actually as smarter, much smarter than you, because when an audience comes together, it immediately becomes infinitely more intelligent than anybody, any single person in the room. And you go forward into the dark and try and keep that hungry, incredibly smart animal in the dark entertained, which is to say, you know, guessing what's going to happen next and trying to keep up with you as opposed to outpacing you by many miles. And, you know, if I wrote a play that was about, you know, being nice to gay people in 1985 or 1975, I would have bored myself writing it, and I would have bored most of the people in the theater so many of them are gay anyway, and the ones who aren't are already, you know, civilized people who understand that you should be nice to gay people because gay people are so nice. And you know, if I wrote a play trying to convince Jesse Helms or Trent Lott or, you know, John Boehner or one of those people what's the difference between right and wrong, it would be incredibly tedious. It would be like having to sit in on, you know, kindergarten class and, you know, how to stack blocks and share your cookies with your friend. It's boring. And when I taught playwriting, I used to say to my students, the greatest crime you can commit as a playwright is to be boring, because it's wasting human life. And if you write a play that has a 6-week run and there are 500 people watching it 8 times a week, for, you know, add up the hours of human life you've wasted, and you've essentially like murdered a toddler by the, you know, so don't be boring. And you know, we've all had the experience. You sit in a play, and it's like, I'll sign the pledge. I won't buy blood diamonds. I promise. I won't. I'll turn off my light. You know, I'll be green. I'll be nice to women or gay people or black people. I mean, I'll, you know, whatever it is that the play is telling you that you ought to do. You know, and now I can go home and watch TV. And I think that that's not what a play should be about. I think it should open up questions and go into places of mystery. It should be about contradiction and paradox and dialectics, and not really be about. It should have the reason to write a play as opposed to writing an essay is that you can be irresponsible as a playwright, and that irresponsibility is a necessary ingredient to the pursuit of truth in a dramatic form. And I think if you can't allow yourself that, then you should probably not be writing plays and should be writing essays instead, which are much more direct. So.
And on that brilliant Tony Kushner note, I unfortunately have to bring things to a close because we're out of time. Our deepest thanks to Tony for being here. We Yeah. Bravo.
Thank you very much.
Wait a minute, I get to do my gavel. I got to do my gavel. Wait a minute. We also thank our audiences here and on radio and on the internet. I'm Brad Rosenstein, and now this joint meeting of the Museum of Performance and Design and the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is now adjourned. Thank you.